This is another state appeal. We are appealing a motion to suppress. When I was preparing to write the brief in this case, as with all of our state appeals, I turned to my beloved Cullen findings of fact. The state, of course, loves that decision. When Kevin Urey filed that petition for discretionary review with the Court of Criminal Appeals and was seeking that, appellate attorneys across the state from the prosecution side were drooling, quite frankly, because it would give us a chance to have teeth in our state appeals. In this case, of course, we timely asked for findings of fact and conclusions of law from the judge of Court 10, and we received a five-sentence document that included findings and conclusions. I worked on my brief. I worked on my statement of facts. I sat there trying to figure out what my points of error would be. I knew what ground I wanted to debate. I wanted to debate whether or not the officer had reasonable suspicion to make the stop. But in looking at the findings of fact, I realized it was impossible. It was an impossible task for me to do that. At page 4 of my brief is a quotation of the findings of fact in this case, and might be helpful for the court to look on there as well. It is five sentences. Let's ignore the first sentence and look at the final four, so to speak, and I'll tell you those are what I would just call throwdowns, gimmies. They're certainly pertinent to the case. The last two show what the ruling is. The second and third statements refer to things that no one contested. There was never a debate whether or not this was a warrantless stop. And there was never any argument from either side that some sort of transportation code violation had occurred. So that's like that jacket that I throw on the back of my door to throw on real quick when I don't have on a suit. That's a gimme. That's a laydown. That means nothing to what we're doing on this appeal.
The record shows that the state did file a request for findings of fact and conclusions of law, which Cullen implies is the best way to do it. But was there a further requirement on the state to, after you received the findings of fact and conclusions of law, to ask for additional findings of fact and conclusions of law?
Well, I think that's what we're doing now. And I think there's more than one way to do that, Your Honor. I recognize that in the defense brief, they argue, we should have filed some sort of pre-brief motion asserting that. You have two mechanisms in the rules of appellate procedure that I think apply to this situation. One is 43.6, which talks about types of judgment, and that gives this court the ability to make, it's kind of an open-ended authority for this court to make orders as necessary, so not just renditioning, affirming, reversing. You can do what you need to do to get the case decided. Then also, what is cited in Cullen is 44.4, and that's the remedial error rule. And, of course, in Cullen, which is somewhat like my case, the state filed a brief arguing that they needed further facts. That's what we're doing here. I don't know that there is a right or wrong. I don't think you lose any right. There's certainly not a preservation for not filing something at the Court of Appeals. And rarely, I can't think of a single situation where a party is required to preserve something that a trial court files in the record. There's no showing in this situation that the state received that until we checked out the appellate record. The record is not specific on that. So we have followed through with what we did. We are in the same posture that Cullen was from San Antonio. So I think there may be more than one way to skin a cat, but it doesn't mean that they're mutually exclusive, Your Honor.
So these findings were contained, I guess, within a document entitled Order on Suppression.
Right.
So your position is that there was no duty on the part of the state to file any kind of motion for additional findings of fact and conclusions of law in the trial court.
Yes, that is my position. And 44.4 shows that that's certainly something that either litigant in a court of appeals can consider. They can ask this court to fix something that wasn't perfect so that This court has the ability to answer the questions it needs to answer. That's precisely what Cullen did, and that's what we're asking here. Obviously, we're not asking for this case to be reversed or affirmed. We're asking for help. This case somewhat reminds me of my Matthew Neal Cox case, which, Judge Casey, you wrote the en banc opinion in that case. You know, the state finds it itself in a posture, even though we've had a state's right to appeal for more than two decades now, sometimes fighting in order to get that right. And there may or may not be reasons for that, but in that case, we were trying to just get the trial judge to sign an order so we could come before this court. Here, we are just trying to get the trial judge to give us specific findings of fact and conclusions of law so that we can debate the legal issues in this arena.
Well, Ms. Tahani, you know, from my perspective, I mean, this is more than we've gotten in cases prior to this. And I'm just wondering, you mentioned fixing this, and just how would you propose that this be fixed either by this court or the trial court? In other words, what more would you say or suggest that needed to be said by the trial judge?
Well, I would follow the guideline for what is essential findings in Cullen, and that court spells out that it has to be something to give this court a leg up. And we know this isn't the first time you've had findings of fact or attempted findings of fact and conclusions of law before you. They don't have to be in one format or another. We know from Cullen the judge could state the findings here. The judge could have said, I find that this officer is wholly incredible in his testimony, and that would have been something that was dispositive for this court to respond to. State wouldn't like it, but it would pour us out on appeal, but that would be a dispositive finding. That would be an essential finding.
Well, he did say, after judging the credibility of the witnesses, the court finds the police officer lacked reasonable suspicion or probable cause to stop.
Well, and I beg to differ a little, because there's an and in there, and he throws in, after reviewing the evidence and judging the credibility
right,
of the witnesses.
But you mentioned credibility. I mean, he's stating that he's judged the credibility and he's making this finding, and I'm just...
I agree, it uses the word.
Just hypothetically, what more would he say?
That the officer was not credible? Or there's not one fact from that was contested at the trial court that is spelled out. Think of Guzman. When this court applies Guzman and considers historical facts or mixed findings of fact and law or legal issues, look at the historical facts. What is the historical fact that was debated in the trial court that is found here? And, you know, let's use one of the cases in the defense brief. State v. Guzman, not the Guzman we use on a daily basis that has our standard of review, but State v. Guzman, which is a Austin Court of Appeals decision, and actually address the adequacy of the findings. And in that case, there were multiple findings typed out in the way that the state often does propose findings. In the opinion, there's at least 11 listed. And in that case, the state complained that there was nothing specifically saying that the officer was either credible or not credible. But the court said, because the findings of fact from the judge followed in lockstep the officer's testimony. He said, I saw a red, I don't remember the substance, but it would be, I saw X, I saw Y, I saw XYZ. And because it said those things, and those were exactly what the officer had testified to, the court was essentially saying, and the Court of Appeals could discern, that the judge found the officer credible. If the judge had entered written findings of fact that the light was green and the officer had testified it was red, then that would be a finding of fact that showed that the trial court did not believe the officer. So it would be a credibility finding. But just looking at what is in State v. Guzman shows us the paucity of what we have here. One of the findings is Officer Sturbeck's car was the third car in line at the stoplight. We don't have any kind of historical fact like that in the five sentences we received from the trial court. Or Officer Sherbeck immediately activated his overhead light and made a traffic stop of the defendant's truck. There is not a salient fact described in here. It is a vague, amorphous, generic finding. And I would say that this finding is what Judge Womack first talked about in State v. Ross in his concurrence, when he said that very brief findings would be a way to cover up, essentially, not intentionally, but to cover up an erroneous ruling. And that is exactly what Judge Womack talked about, and that is what was elevated to the majority in the Cullen decision. And in fact, after the Cullen decision was decided in Amador, a Court of Criminal Appeals case that is 221 Southwest 3rd 666, the hearing in that case was predated the Cullen holding, but the court in Austin was saying, hey, guys, we'll have an easier time reviewing these kind of cases after people start doing specific findings of fact and conclusions of law. And they said it's extremely difficult to determine from the record whether the judge made a legal ruling on this issue or not, because there weren't. That's what we're asking for, is something to give this court the ability to rule. Now, Justice Casey, you asked me what would I say. I can think of a couple here. And, you know, brevity is really quantity, not quality. Brevity would suffice. You could come out with a one sentence saying here something along the line that the officer in this case, the driving facts observed by the officer in this case were insufficient to find reasonable suspicion. That at least would give us a little more. Or the barely hitting the curb two times, or pulling out in front of the police officer so they had to slow but not take evasive action is insufficient to warrant the officer's belief, as he stated in the record here, that the person was DWI. Or, of course, you could say that the officer's testimony lacked credibility. That's a one-sentence, very simple finding that would decide this case. And we just want something specific. But that first sentence, after reviewing the evidence and judging the credibility of the witnesses, the court finds that the police officer lacked reasonable suspicion or probable cause to stop the defendant's vehicle. That doesn't even allow you to discern which Guzman standard applies, because it throws facts and credibility into the same finding. And that's one of the things that is not really talked about in the cases, but we have findings of fact and conclusions of law. And because they're bunched up together here and there's no specific facts, that's the problem with these findings of fact and conclusions of law.
But there were only people to testify at the hearing were the officer and appellant, correct?
That's correct.
And then they showed the videotape.
That's right.
Okay. So the fact that the Parse finding of fact that we do have says that after reviewing the evidence and judging the credibility clearly implies that the trial court made a credibility distinction between the only two witnesses there. Correct? I mean, the fact that he's considering credibility at all indicates that he drew a credibility distinction between the only two witnesses there. It might be, in other words, I think your position would be stronger if there were multiple witnesses, multiple police officers, but because there's only two, a credibility determination necessarily implies he believed one, he disbelieved the other.
What's interesting in this case, Judge, is what the officer says is what's shown on the video. And then actually, the other interesting part of it is, with the exception of whether or not Ms. Freud had been drinking, her testimony shows, yes, indeed, she came out of the bar parking lot and pulled quickly in front of the officer. But she talks about potholes instead. And so, but we don't know if he finds the officer incredible. It doesn't say. We don't know if he found Ms. Freud incredible. We don't know if somehow he couldn't see the video. We don't know what evidence the trial court was trusting or distrusting here, and actually we don't know if he was distrusting based on this. Judging the credibility of the witnesses doesn't say, I found somebody incredible or I found them credible. It doesn't define, it's just an amorphous concept that needs further elaboration.
So would you agree that if we agreed with you that all we need to do is abate and remand for findings? More specific findings and
absolutely
pending appeal.
That is exactly what the state is requesting under 44.4B of the Rules of Appellate Procedure. With that, I think I'll wait with that question. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Davis?
Chief Justice Casey, Justice Livingston, Justice Walker. May it please this honorable court, counsel. My name is Patrick Davis, and I represent Ms. Tina Freud, the appellee in this case, out of Judge Phil Searle's court, County Court Number 10 here in Tarrant County. Right away, Justice Livingston made a point, almost felt like she was reading my mind or I was reading hers, where she asked the state, did they do anything to follow up? And then Chief Justice Casey followed up on that with, hey, what do we do to fix it? What do we do to fix it? So I say to Chief Justice Casey, let's look at what Judge Myers did in Colon. We know that Judge Myers in Colon said, we looked to Rule 297 of the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure in deciding Colon and helping the state out in Colon, which now gives us the right to request findings of fact and conclusions of law when we lose, and gives the state that right as well. Now, Chief Justice Casey, let's just go one rule up. There's no reason why we can't fix this problem by looking to Rule 298 of the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure. We looked at Rule 297, and Chief Justice Casey, I know you know Rule 298 like your esteemed colleagues do, but I'll read it. Additional or amended findings of fact and conclusions of law. After the court files original findings of fact and conclusions of law, any party may file with the clerk of the court a request for specified additional or amended findings or conclusions. The request for these findings shall be made within 10 days after the filing of the original findings and conclusions by the court. Each request made pursuant to this rule shall be served on each party to the suit in accordance with Rule 21A. The court shall file any additional or amended findings and conclusions that are appropriate within 10 days after such request is filed and cause a copy to be mailed to each party to the suit. No findings or conclusions shall be deemed or presumed by any failure of the court to make any additional findings or conclusions. Recently, in the Smith v. Abbott case against the Attorney General, Greg Abbott, out of the Court of Appeals in Austin, this same issue, Judge, on July 31st, 2009, its third point, the Court of Appeals said, hey, the findings of fact were filed. You guys did not come back and complain about those findings of fact and conclusions of law and comply with Rule 298, and you should have. And therefore, they denied them relief. So I think it goes back to what Justice Livingston was stating when she said, did you do anything afterwards? And I submit to you, Justice Livingston, no, they did not. And I think the big thing here, and I know Justice Livingston and Justice Walker have written a lot of decisions, authored a lot of decisions on speedy trials, and I know speedy trial is something that this court has to protect. Tina Freud has a right, Chief Justice Casey, to a speedy trial. To allow the state to come in, these findings of fact and conclusions of law, Justice Walker, were filed by Judge Searle's on October 23rd, 2008. It is November 3rd, 2009. It is almost 1 year later. Her attorney, her trial attorney, I was not the trial attorney in this case, her trial attorney did her job. She prepared this for trial. She got a favorable ruling. And to fix the problem, Judge, we can't allow the state to come into your court a year later and tell you they've got a problem with the findings of fact and conclusions of law. We know if we look at Blocker out of Waco, clearly look at what Tom Gray says, look what Chief Justice Gray of the 10th Court of Appeals says in Blocker. There's nothing that prevents them still from going and attacking the issue of whether or not the trial court judge was correct or incorrect in granting the motion to suppress. There was nothing that prevented Ms. Dehoney from still pursuing that issue. Yes, raise this issue as number one. If you lose on it, then go forward and raise the issue on whether or not Judge Searle's abused his discretion in granting the motion to suppress. That was not done here. Going back and looking at the spirit of Colon, we know that we can look to the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure for guidance on issues. And Chief Justice Casey, I implore this court to look to Rule 298 because that answers it. I, as a criminal defense attorney, I can say that I have been in the position of Ms. Dehoney many times and had to abate. But I think it's gotten to a point where we need to tell the defense bar in the state of Texas when you need to look at these findings of fact and conclusions of law. Almost like when we get the reporter's record and the clerk's record, I know that you folks are very strict, and you say, hey, your time's running, Mr. Davis. Here it starts. In 30 days, your brief is due. So I better make sure, if there was a hearing on a motion for new trial, that that's included in the record. I better make sure my record is all ready so that I can go forward. You have that duty as appellate counsel. In this case, that was not done. The state went forward, and they're saying reverse and remand, but we know what they're asking for. Justice Livingston, they're asking for an abatement. They're asking for an abatement a year later. And I submit to you, based on Rule 298 of the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure and the logic of Judge Meyer's unanimous decision in Colon, that it is too late. It is too late to come back. Now, barring that aside, if you don't agree with me on the waiver issue, the Austin court in Guzman, the 2003 decision, not to be confused, excuse me, the 2007 decision, not to be confused with Guzman from 1997, the Austin court denied the state relief on the requested finding, holding, we must afford almost total deference to the trial court's finding of historical fact, and this deference is not dependent on an express finding by the trial court that the testimony on which it relied was credible. Such a finding is implicit in the court's having based its findings on that testimony. We can't hold trial court judges to sit here and say, I believe Officer X more than I believe defendant Freud, or I believe Officer X is, as far as this is concerned, the curb and this, this, and this, but I believe Miss Freud as far as the potholes are concerned. You can't do that. We'd be tied down forever, and the trial court judges do not need that added pressure. The trial court judge in this case provided timely findings of fact. If the state, again, had a problem with that, then they should have advanced that argument and not advance it by asking for reverse and remand. And if you look at N. Ray Graves as well, Chief Justice Gray again goes through and talks about how abatement was the vehicle. Abatement is the vehicle, not to wait. I think this court is in a very great position in the sense that this issue really has not been advanced in any other appellate court. I did extensive research on it. And so I think this court is in a position where the Court of Criminal Appeals will surely agree with you if you engraft a Rule 298 type of timetable on Colon and see if they follow it. I don't see why Judge Myers and his colleagues would not follow it.
Would you contend that that should go work both ways? That if it were
absolutely, Judge. I think the abatement issue, Chief Justice Casey. Justice Walker, Justice Livingston, how many times have you folks seen these abatements come in? I've done it myself, so I'm just as guilty as anyone. I've done it 2 months, and I know that the court sometimes isn't too happy with me, thinking probably, hey, Patrick, you know, why didn't you look at this before? How can you be down to the last 2 days of your brief being due, and you've got a problem with fines of fact and conclusions of law? So, yes, Chief Justice Casey, I think this court is in a position where it can fix it, and it needs to work both ways, because I think the defense bar, again, I'm just as guilty as the rest, and the state of Texas, I think we've sort of taken it for granted and abused it when we got down to the deadline, and to meet the deadline, we come in and say, hey, abate. In this case, I think, again, even if you don't go with the waiver, please don't make our trial court judges go and have to say whether they believe a witness or not. That's not what State v. Guzman, the 1997 Court of Criminal Appeals decision, said. We have to give total deference or we'd be here forever.
One problem is when you've got an appeal like this, and no offense to the state, but you got, you know, this a year has passed and the judge may not even remember
sure
the case. I mean, I guess he could look to the record, but he's not. The record's not going to reflect what he might have thought about credibility at the time. It might jog his memory, but, I mean,
right.
There is that concern, I would think.
Right. And I, Judge, I've run into that. And basically, yes, he'd probably have to check out the appellate record from Deborah and go down and read it because he's not going to remember any of it. But I think at the very end, and this is with all due respect, I feel like the state in this particular case wanted a treasure map to reversal and remand. And I think if they did want that treasure map, they waived it when they didn't complain when they got the original map. And how many things do we have to say? I went through and I gave you, I showed you McCorders, and I quoted Terry, and I cited State v. Huddleston, and we have to show these things, that it was a warrantless arrest, or it was a warrantless stop. I went through the analysis. There was enough there, and nothing under Blocker prevented them from still briefing it. I encourage you to read Chief Justice Gray's dissent in that particular case, and read In Re Graves by Chief Justice Gray of the 10th Court of Appeals as well, because I think he's right on point. But the big thing is, from the very beginning, as I wrap up, Chief Justice Casey, we do need to fix it, and I don't see any reason why the Court of Criminal Appeals would not agree that we look to Rule 298 for guidance as we did Rule 297. And so that's why I said that Justice Livingston read my mind, because I'm sure she was thinking 298 as well, and then it clicked on me. And hopefully that's where we arrive. But anyway, again, the issue of whether or not the trial court abused its discretion in granting the motion to suppress has been waived as well. It's not before this court. I am asking for the reasons stated in Appellee's brief that you affirm the judgment of the trial court in this case. If there are no further questions, may I be seated, Mr. Chief Justice? Thank you.
Yes. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, you do get rebuttal. I was just saying, what are you doing?
It's the only time the state
so
gets to have a defense
to
sandwich.
Yeah, exactly. Sorry.
I needed a breath. Thank you, Judge, for making that comment.
You
because
just
I needed
surprised
a breath.
Me. That's all.
Never am I really... I try not to let too many things. I laugh and say, unless it involves the injury of small children, I don't get distressed. But the argument that was just voiced bothers me. I want to address the procedure.
It seems perfectly logical to me that the state's not satisfied with the findings that the trial court made at its request. It come back and say, Judge, would you, give us something more specific?
As we have done, as we have followed Cullen, and while the rules of civil procedure do not apply to this case, and of course the Court of Criminal Appeals, who makes that sort of policy and can make that rule, already did in Cullen, and they grafted what they thought was a good procedure to go back. Now the Court of Criminal Appeals.
But did the Court of Criminal Appeals and Cullen have the same situation that we have here?
Not precisely, but okay.
So they didn't have an opportunity maybe to go to the next step. To 298.
No, but other cases have abated for this very reason, as we're doing here. And, it makes me think there's other issues like this that the defense could make the same argument. If this court lacks jurisdiction, there's more than one way you could file a motion by the state to say there's no jurisdiction.
Ms. Dahoney, just in the interest of judicial economy and speedy trials and doesn't it just make more sense to have this taken care of in the trial court while everything's fresh on the judge's mind, rather than appeal it and then ask the Court of Appeals to send it back to the trial court to do the very thing the state could have asked the trial court to do a year ago?
I think that's certainly a possibility. But, Judge, I have been Texas versus Trevino at the United States Supreme Court, which was remanded 10 years after the trial for an abatement hearing that I was the attorney on in the trial court on Batson, asking the trial judge, who is a member of this court, and all of the parties to remember the Batson facts. That happens. Unfortunately, I think it was John Onion who coined the term appellate orbit. We're not thrilled about it. It happens sometimes. I understand this
but
is later.
That was before the high court adopted Rule 297. I mean, so something's changed since then in terms of directions the court has gone.
Where rules existed in Spence v. State, one of the Lake Waco murder cases, the first Spence opinion was to remand for a hearing on it's not speedy trial, but it's pretrial delay. That's the issue, sorry. Kind of that was remanded. That law had been in effect forever. It was remanded at least 2 or 3 years after the fact for that purpose. Unfortunately, that happens, and that's what we're faced with here.
But, okay, take the state out of this for a second, just for the purposes of this case. Just kind of step back a minute and just tell me, do you really do you really believe that it's more sensible and logical to require an appeal for the purpose of an abatement to send it back to the trial court to make the more specific findings than it would be to have a rule where the state and or the defendant goes to the trial court soon after the initial findings are made and asks for more specific findings, which is the very thing that you're asking us to order the trial court to do now? Which makes more sense?
In high theory, that sounds great, Judge.
In practice, what makes it unworkable?
We deal with a lack of judicial economy on a daily basis in all different respects.
So judicial economy is built into the system, and we ought to perpetuate it, is what you're
saying. No, I don't want it perpetuated, but I don't want it held against me if there's a woulda, coulda, shoulda argument in this situation when Cullen gives us a way to take care of this. And other courts across the state have abated for findings of fact. No, this is unique in the adequacy, although the state v. Guzman addressed the adequacy question, and they found against the state there. I want to finish, because my time is short, with that thinking of that last sentence or that first sentence in the findings of fact and conclusions of law, and then think of the myriad cases this court has faced that were state appeals, like State v. Salo more than 10 years ago, Atkins, Glover, all of those. That sentence could apply to each and every blessed one of them. That is how thin this finding of fact is. It doesn't tell, it is generic, strapped on to any case where there was a stop. And this court has faced probably 30, 40 of those decisions, maybe more. That finding could apply to any of them because it doesn't truly apply to this case. It was just a kick it out the door in hopes of being affirmed here.
Thank you, Ms. Dahoney.
Thank you.
Mr. Davis, thank you both for appearing here this morning to present your arguments. The case is submitted. The third case in our 9 o'clock docket wave, so we'll take a recess at this time and come back at 10:30 for the 10:30 case. Thank you.